Welcome to the Everyone's a Critic Movie Review Podcast. I'm your co-host, Bob Zarrell. With me, as always, is professional film critic Sean Patrick. Visit us at ihatecritics.net, everyonesacriticpodcast.com. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Our handle is CriticsPod. You can listen to us at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Alexa, Stitcher. I believe over in India there's a platform called Gaana. YouTube, anywhere you get your podcast, subscribe to the show, write and review the show, comment on the show if you're on YouTube or whatever. We'll try to interact with you, read your reviews on the show and whatnot. And patreon.com/criticspod is the best way to help support the podcast. We also have a TeePublic page if you search Critics Pod in there, or go to ihatecritics.net and click on the TeePublic link up in the right-hand corner. Two great ways to help support the podcast, and take pictures of your merch if you do get some. Before we get going too far, Sean Connery passed away at the age of 90 years old.
Hasn't acted since 2012. He made an animated film at that time, which was bizarre. Do you know about this?
I feel like we talked about it on the pod. We were doing the podcast then, weren't we? Or did it come out later?
Yeah, we might have mentioned it. He plays a skateboarding grandpa.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure we talked about it way back then. That's kind of my limited experience with that. And it's been, what, before that one was the last time he acted?
League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, 2003.
Holy shit, that was really his last movie?
Yeah. Yeah, I think he just did. He made that movie. He's like, fuck this, I'm done.
Wow,
that's my guess anyway, just based off of it, based off of the how terrible that movie was and how bad everybody's experience on that movie was. It's kind of appropriate that he would just go, forget it, no, I'm never doing this again. I got enough money, I got everything I need, I'm out.
What was the movie that made him do that movie? Like, he passed on something.
He passed on Lord of the Rings. I know that. He was offered the role of, he was also offered Dumbledore, I believe.
Well, he passed on a comic book movie, and then it went out to be a huge hit, so then he took this one up. Was it X-Men or something like that? I don't know what he would have been in X-Men, but I don't remember what the story was.
He could have been Magneto.
Yeah, I don't remember exactly what it was, but he didn't get it. And then all of a sudden the movie turned into a huge success. And he's like, all right, I'll do this one. And apparently he was a real prick during it. But what do I know? I wasn't there.
I mean, also, I think the movie was really bad. So he's probably having that experience from the very beginning. He's like, I would be in a bad mood, too, if I started to realize the movie I was making was not very good.
But what if it was good and he made it bad? Because he wouldn't do things that were in the comic book. That's kind of things I heard about that he was doing. Oh man!
Favorite Sean Connery movie?
Jeez, I don't know. That is a great question.
It is hard because for me, like I mean, it's not hard for me because I know which one I've seen, the one that you haven't. So I'm. That we're going to talk about next week, but so I've got that one in my back pocket, and I don't have to pick anything from the James Bond universe, which I already don't like. So,
yeah, I definitely don't like the James Bond universe. I mean, I feel like I remember liking Just Cause, but I don't remember. Maybe it sucked. Hunt for Red October, I liked.
Yeah, that's a really good movie.
Obviously, The Untouchables was good, but kind of overrated. Good.
Finding Forrester.
Yeah, that's Goodwill Hunting wannabe. Yeah, I honestly am not a huge fan of Sean Connery when it all comes down to it. I mean, I'm looking forward to Marnie.
Marnie's a really good movie. That's why I'm happy to talk about that next week as the classic. It's really good. It's Hitchcock, Sean Connery, Tippi Hedren. Yeah, all good elements there.
And he was in the Indiana Jones you hated.
Yeah. Yeah, because I was looking through my own... the extensive list of things I've written about over the years, trying to find something to share about Sean Connery. I'm like, I can't share the movie I hated. that would be a dick move.
Yeah.
But then I guess a lot of people had not many nice things to say about him.
I mean, I'd probably like Robin Hood. He's barely in that. I'm just not a fan. So, I mean, that's really what Highlander, he was in that. Jesus Christ. I don't know if Time Bandits is any good. Great Train Robbery. I feel like I've seen that.
Zardoz.
If that's a reference to that movie, I don't remember it. So it didn't stick with me.
All that anyone should know about that is he's wearing a giant red diaper.
The Great Train Robbery?
Zardoz.
Oh, I just heard you say Zardoz, and I thought you were referencing something from that movie that I didn't know about. So that's a completely different movie. Okay, I gotcha. I do know the picture of him in the diaper. I just didn't know
what that Zardoz came should be the classic next week.
It's up to you. Oh, there it is, Zardoz.
Yeah, just go to Google Images and hit Zardoz, and you'll see.
Can it be the classic? Let's see.
We didn't actually confirm if Marnie is actually available.
It appears to be on Amazon, at least. Both of them do.
Literally, the first image you see is him in his red diaper and bandolier. I mean, this is a look. I don't know if people, if you've never seen Zardoz, folks, you need to look up Zardoz, because he's wearing a bandolier that is acting as, I guess, a way of holding up his red diaper, and he's wearing thigh-high leather boots and
a lot of body hair.
Super long ponytail.
Yeah, and lots of body hair.
I mean, it's a look. It's a choice, you know? You're not going to forget it anytime soon. Slap that on a poster. Everybody's going to remember it.
Yeah. I mean, if we want to get rid of a couple movies, we might do both.
Sean Connery tribute episode, Marnie and Zardoz.
Just making fun of them. Oh, the best and the worst.
We only watch non-James Bond Sean Connery movies.
Yeah, I mean, we've done enough Bond when Josh was on the show, so I think we're good. Were you named after Sean Connery? Is that what I read on Twitter? How does that feel?
Yeah, my mom named me after Sean Connery, the S-E-A-N specifically. She liked the spelling, but she also attracted to him as James Bond.
That's cool. My sister was named after the main character in Scarecrow and Mrs. King. Very random,
I know. Your sister's name is Mrs. King?
It's Amanda. But yes. Oh, that's funny. But yeah, rest in peace, Sean Connery. I don't know. It's weird kind of seeing... You know, it's probably over the next few years we're going to start seeing some of our favorite actors start to go, and it's, I don't know, it'll be weird. So
yeah, wistful. But thank you for mainstreaming misogyny for so many years, Sean. We appreciate it. Sorry, I couldn't. I don't know. That was what was going around on Twitter, which is not wrong. It's not wrong.
No,
it's true.
Yeah. All right. Should we get into the regular show?
Sure.
All right. Let's just go ahead and start with The Kraft Legacy.
Yes, The Kraft Legacy is a sequel to the 1996 movie The Kraft, and features four new young witches who are high schoolers. They are welcoming a new member, their fourth, to their coven. Terrific cast here. Kaylee Spaney is the lead actress as Lily, but also she's joined by Zoe Luna, Lovey Simone, and oh, I lost the other girl's name. But they're together as they kind of draft in Lily to be their fourth after they recognize that she's carrying some First off, she's got this necklace that's kind of a pagan necklace, and then they recognize that she has some powers when she seems to throw a guy across a room using her powers that she doesn't really know that she has. They help her to kind of develop those powers, and between the four of them, they show off a great deal of power. Meanwhile, in the background, what's happening is that she's moved to this new town with her mom, played by Michelle Monaghan, who's fallen in love with David Duchovny, who plays Adam. And David Duchovny is playing essentially a Jordan Peterson-like character. You're familiar with Jordan Peterson?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, he's a monster. He's an awful human being. And David Duchovny, playing him, essentially really does get to the kind of nasty, gross appeal of him and lots of men's rights activists like him. And it's hard to talk about his character and avoid spoilers, but I want to try and avoid spoilers as much as possible because I do want people to see this movie. I really enjoyed this. There's a character in the movie named Timmy who starts off as this antagonist to Lily. He's there at this most humiliating moment of her first day of school and really makes that really terrible and continues to make her life rough until she and her coven turn him woke with a spell. And I thought that is a really clever modern twist. And what he becomes is a really sweetheart of a guy who's really thoughtful and sensitive and not a joke. Like, they don't turn him into this running gag of wokeness. They turn him into a guy who's genuinely sensitive, and they use this to actually reveal who he really is. And a lot of the time you're not even sure if this is coming from entirely from their spell or if this was actually something that was in him that they've just brought out of him. And I really love the way this young man, Nicholas Galitzine, really played this aspect of this character. I was really impressed. I kept waiting for it to turn into a running joke, and they don't turn it into a running joke. They adopt him into their group, and they make him one of their friends, and he becomes a love interest for Lily. And I really enjoyed that aspect of it. I was impressed. But I was impressed by a lot of this movie. I thought it was actually superior to the original, which the original is all about turning women against each other in the end, and women with power going, using that power against each other. And I like that this movie doesn't necessarily go there all the way. It hints at that, but then it faints in a different direction and a much better direction for my taste. I enjoyed this a lot more than I expected to.
I had never seen the original going into this. So I watched this one first, and it's, I guess, only thing I can say about it is it's fine. It's very safe, in my opinion. But at the same time, it flew by in terms of its watchability. Like, next thing I knew, it was over. And it, in some ways, it bugs me because it felt like the story didn't have time to develop. And, it was a little clunky, I guess. But really, usually when something's clunky, it's not watchable. So it's weird that I'm describing it that way. But it just kind of, I don't know. It was fine. It was good. I didn't mind it. And I actually, when I went back and watched The Craft, the original one, and I actually prefer that to this one. And I guess I see your point, but I never really put the woman part on it. I just saw the power corrupts kind of thing, and I didn't really. Yeah. I think that would have, whether it was men or women, I feel like it would have gone that direction. And I didn't love that movie either. Don't get me wrong; I'm not acting like it's a great movie, but I liked the. I guess I bought into that more, and it's not that I wanted the women to get corrupted. I bought into the Craft Legacy too. It's very watchable. It's a decent movie. And I apparently there's a big cult following around the Craft. So maybe that also would make it, if I knew more about that, it might make it more annoying to me. I don't know.
I don't know much about the cult either, other than that it exists. I didn't realize, it's interesting. Like I said, we were talking about this a couple weeks ago where this movie like this or The Witches or Hocus Pocus, with more women breaking into fandom and bringing out their fandom more, we're finding out more about movies of the 90s that the women our age are loved these movies, but they didn't express it the way we expressed our love for Star Wars or the movies that we loved right. So much and so loudly. And it's kind of fascinating now to arrive at a place where women are taking over fandom spaces a little bit more and putting this stuff out there.
And there's nothing wrong with it. I mean, The Craft's a solid movie. It's just it's just a movie. You know, if I found out there was a cult around it, I'd watch it, similar to Star Wars. Granted, Star Wars was groundbreaking, but in terms of the storyline, it's just, okay, it was tight, it was good, but I mean, what? I don't get it. In terms of why everybody likes it so much, other than the special effects nature of it, and I similar to Kraft is the same kind of thing. The story's fine, it's tight, there's nothing wrong with it. I thought Fairuza Balk was really good in it, if that's how you pronounce her name. I'm assuming it is.
Yeah.
And they never really seemed to be a group in that one as much as they were in the second one, too. So I don't know. It's definitely a sequel to the first one. It's not a remake or anything. It lives within the same world, which is cool. And I like them both. They're just kind of there. There's nothing wrong with them. There's nothing great about them. I agree with you about the Timmy character. I thought that was really cool. They never play it off as a joke, but in the first one they do that, a different version of that. It's more of a love spell, which is kind of typical, which I actually prefer the new one, you know, what they do in the new one opposed to the first one in terms of the spell they put on the guy.
Right.
But I thought both did it well. Neither one played it for a joke. Both, you know, you couldn't really tell if it was a spell or if they were drawing truth feelings out of the guy. I don't know. It's definitely worth watching. I would even say, you know, especially if you're a fan of the original and you're part of that cult, if you will, for lack of a better word. I'm not trying to say that in a demeaning way. Definitely check out the Kraft Legacy. It's worth the $20. Watch it with your family or whatever. It's PG-13, and it's more of, like I said, it's a safer movie, but there's nothing wrong with safe sometimes, especially in a movie like this. It's good. I got nothing bad to say about it. David Duchovny's creepy.
I gotta say, this kid, this Nicholas Galitzine, I was, you know, early on I thought he was gonna be this stock character, they're gonna, you know, drop his pants in the hallway or something, and then he'll be gone. And that he became part of the story, and then he became so awesomely sympathetic. I was really surprised, and then it had some impact later on when other things happened. I was really surprised that they went where they went with that, and they handled it so very, very well.
And I'm really happy they didn't try to recreate the original. They did that. I mean, the four girls outside of the star is clearly going the same route as the main character from The Kraft. But, you know, one's not Fairuza Balk, one's not Neve Campbell. You know, they're all their own individual characters, which I thought was really cool.
Yeah, and one of them's trans, which I thought that's a wonderful inclusion, too. I would have loved to have seen them explore her character a little bit more, but at the very least, you know, it's a little bit of representation, at the very least.
And it didn't feel like it wasn't like a sore thumb thing. It was just kind of naturally written into the story, and so, you know, it was done the right way on top of that, where you don't have to worry about, I guess you always have to worry about fucking right wingers whining and rolling their eyes over shit. But I thought it was done very well. It's just a very tight movie. I guess one complaint I have, and this is sort of a spoiler, but I'm not going to say it all the way through, is Kaylee the star, was she the main girl? I don't remember all their names.
Lily. Kaylee Spaney.
Yeah. She looks an awfully light, a lot like Michelle Monaghan, at least especially in certain things they do. So when that happened, I was like, what the fuck? The whole time I'm going, this is perfect casting. They're a great mother-daughter duo. So that bugged me a little bit. But I don't know. It's definitely worth watching if you're a fan of the original. And even if you're not, I think you can get something out of it. But if you're not, like, I don't know. If I'm someone like you, like, say, based on your review, I would say don't spend the $20. I'd wait for Netflix. So, you know, someone like me or
my
you,
positive review.
But you know what I'm saying? Would you pay $20 to see it, though? I know you liked it, but
by myself, no. It wouldn't be worth it to me to pay $20 by myself, no.
That's what I'm getting at. I think it's a good, solid movie. If you're a fan of this type of, you know, of The Kraft or this type of movie, then by all means spend the $20. If you're a casual person like me, maybe it's not fair to lump you into a casual, you know, enjoying this on a, it's a good movie level. I don't know. I don't know what I'm saying. I would wait for Netflix.
I'm letting you hang yourself. It's out
there. I would wait for Netflix unless you're a huge fan of The Kraft. That's all I'm saying.
All right.
Or you got a big group with you, which you shouldn't have during a pandemic. Anything else on Illinois. Yeah, anything else on the Kraft legacy?
No, I like it a lot. And I mean, it's not brilliant. There's a lot wrong with it. But for, you know, if this was in theaters, I would be happy to see this be a hit.
Yeah, I agree with that. If this was in theaters, I'd say go see it. No problem. It's the pandemic version where you have to pay $20 to see it on TV that makes me hesitant to just say go rent it. Maybe next year.
Maybe next year is a documentary about Philadelphia Eagles fans in the year 2017 when the Eagles went to the Super Bowl and defeated the New England Patriots. It sets up a story about four disparate fans who are each different aspects of fandom that are charming in their way. You've got middle-aged black woman who is obviously not typical in fandom spaces like this. She's a star on local radio. She calls in to the Eagles radio show every Friday and gives like a sermon essentially about why she feels that God owes the Eagles a Super Bowl. Then you've got angry Eagles fan who's became a YouTube sensation because he basically destroyed his bedroom one time after an Eagles loss. You've got this retiree named Larry, who just is a charming dude who just really loves the Eagles. He, instead of taking his retirement in Florida, he takes all of his retirement money and builds himself the ultimate Eagles man cave and then invites his entire neighborhood over to watch Eagles games with him. And the final guy is this average Joe, this ordinary guy who is going through some stuff, who's got a son who's autistic, and he's trying to use being an Eagles fan and teaching the kid to be an Eagles fan as a way to bond with a kid who probably may never love sports or may never even take the time to care about sports, but has at least early on in his life acknowledged something that his father loves and is willing to go with that. And it's lovely to see a couple scenes of them connecting over that. And the boy, I don't know if the boy is trying, but at least he's acknowledging it. And it's that in that way that kind of autistic kids do. And then you have him. Then he's also dealing with the fact that his father is sick and possibly dying, and may not live long enough to see the Eagles win a Super Bowl. And that becomes a very minor thread in the movie, but it underlines this guy's character and makes him more interesting. And all throughout, they really capture these stories very well. I went into this thinking, it's an Eagles documentary. We're going to hear about, Santa Claus and all the horrible things that Philly fans have done over the years. And I wasn't necessarily won over by Eagles fandom. I still think there's a lot wrong with the Eagles fans for their attitudes. And the stories don't go away.
Right.
But I was charmed by these people. And there's kind of a sad clown quality to the angry Eagles fan who is absolutely almost wonderfully unintentionally unaware how funny he is and how kind of, I don't want to call him pathetic and I don't want to be mean, but it is, he lives with his dad and he goes on a lot in the documentary about wishing he had a girlfriend. Like, that's the one thing he really wishes he had was a girlfriend. And it's just, when you hear a guy talk like that, it's like, oh, dude, like, that's a lovely thing to have. But the way you talk about it, you sound like a 17-year-old or a 16-year-old kid in high school and not a grown man.
Do you look like Bradley Cooper?
No. He's a 350-pound black guy.
So it's not a Silver Linings Playbook type. Yeah, it's... Sounds like, we have all these opinions, not just Eagles fans, but people from Philadelphia in general. but, a movie like this can humanize some of them, and that's a good thing. I'm interested in it when it becomes widely available. I feel that way about Cardinal fans as well, but then you go down there, and some of them are the nicest people in the world when you're a Cub fan, and they just want to sit and talk baseball, and it's great. Then you get your douchebag. I don't know. It's nice to put a face to the fandom and then lighten it a little bit, even though as a whole, it's going to be tough to overcome that. If I had known,
there have been a few well-documented incidents when it comes to Philly fan over the years. And yeah, the as a Bears fan, it particularly stings to think about, like, what was it, Willie Gault or McKinnon, one of them's been playing in Philadelphia, and he trips over the awful turf there, breaks both his legs, and the Eagles fans cheer. They yep. cheer as he's carted off the field because they're horrible human beings.
Anybody who cheers an injury is crappy. I mean, I get the mob mentality part of it too, and people do things they wouldn't normally do on their own. That's why I think a movie like this is important, to show them as humans and individuals rather than a mob. But still, that did happen. If I'd known you're going to watch this, we could have done like the big fan or whatever that was called. That'd have been a great classic to go with this. I love that movie.
That's a great movie.
So much fun. This sounds like, is Kevin Hart in it at all?
No, he's not mentioned once that I'm aware of. I didn't even know he's a Philly fan.
I believe he famously got really drunk and snuck onto the field after they won. And I think that was Kevin. I think that happened. Maybe I'm confusing it with another. He did that at some championship, and I could have swore it was Philly. All right. From here on, the episode gets weird. We're going to talk about a newish movie that's on Netflix, but the reason we're talking about it is because the movie from 1990 happened. Then we got our classic, but the reason that's our classic is because of 1990. So we're going to kind of go out of order here, and we'll start with Jacob's Ladder 2020-2019.
Yeah, starring Michael Ealy and Jesse K. Williams, and it's not even a Jacob's Ladder scenario that's in play here, which is bizarre for a make of Jacob's Ladder. Jacob's Ladder 2019 features Michael Ealy playing playing Jacob, who's a Iraq War vet, who's a doctor and has a family and a wife, but a baby. But he's also got a brother who he thought was dead, who thought he died in Afghanistan, and he finds out that he might still be alive, and finds him living as a homeless drug addict under the subway. And he goes and saves him and brings him home. And weird things start happening to him. He starts having these weird flashes and these sort of – just these incidents keep happening to him where he's kind of losing portions of his own reality. And his brother is starting to get better, and he's starting to get worse. And he's wondering why that is. And we're going to come to find out that perhaps maybe he's not who he thinks he is, and maybe his brother is not who he thought he was. And – that's kind of where the story is going to turn. I was really confused, mostly by this. It's a really boring film, considering, you know, that the original Jacob's Ladder has a lot of, you know, really striking imagery and a lot of really as flawed as that movie is, it's got it's striking, it's memorable, and the twist of that movie is a solid one. This movie has its own twist, but it's also not the Jacob's Ladder. It's not the Jacob's Ladder twist.
No, this movie sucks. I mean, and I feel bad because I get what they're trying to do, and it's kind of ballsy. But they, one, like you said, they don't take the Jacob's. They call it Jacob's Ladder, and the part of the movie they bring is the drug, the secret drug, and it have nothing to do with the ladder, Jacob's Ladder part of it. So that right there is kind of like, well, call it something else then. Two, it's just super clunky in a bad way. I know I said Craft Legacy was clunky in a good way. This is just, it's almost unwatchable in some ways. It doesn't make sense. And at least the twist in the first one and the images make up for the fact that it doesn't make sense at times. This one, the payoff is just kind of like, okay, but the fact that it was confusing and boring, there wasn't enough there to overcome that. Not that the original does either, but it does more so than this. To me, it was just a massive miss. They couldn't decide what movie they wanted to make, and they made almost three different movies at the same time. And I don't know. They should have made their own movie based on PTSD, which I think is what they wanted to do, and he wanted to use Jacob's Ladder to get there. And to me, you throw that out, do your PTSD movie, and make it more watchable and make more sense. Instead, they handcuffed themselves and then they couldn't get unlocked.
I also think that Michael Ealy is miscast here. He's a fine actor. He's a very good actor in a lot of different things, but I think he's just so bland and so dull here, and he's so monotone throughout. He doesn't really dig into this, and this kind of needs an almost like Nicolas Cage level of intensity to really carry it off. If you're going to pull off the kind of twist that he's pulling off, you kind of need a little bit more intensity, not a basically like a very quiet performance. This is not a quiet time. This needs some insanity to really liven things up, and he just doesn't even have the willingness to go there.
Well, I agree completely, but I also blame the director for that more so than him, because I don't think he wanted that, and I think that's a mistake. I think you need someone over the top to at least make it watchable or something to get your interest in it somehow. And he was trying to make it too serious. He handcuffs himself by making it a remake. And it's just an overall disaster, which, you know, thankfully, probably no one's talking about it but us. So at least he has that going for him, that it won't come back and bite him later on, hopefully. Because sometimes you just kind of get in over your head and you can't get out, and I think that's what happened here.
Yeah. Meanwhile, the original 1990 Jacob's Ladder is not a bad movie. I like a lot of it. It's just it's two movies, and these two movies don't really go together. One is this message picture about the way the government mistreated veterans, and then this other movie is this supernatural horror movie that's all about these super creepy images and this big twist at the end. And I liked that movie. The other movie is very preachy and really doesn't fit. These two things don't fit together, this message movie. So the story goes that Jacob and his team were in Vietnam, and the government tried to do some sort of experiment on them that went terribly wrong, to the point where now back in the U.S., the war is over. They've survived. They've come back, and they're all having these nightmares. And it's not quite PTSD. It's more like Agent Orange, I guess, is what they're really talking about in many ways. It's more specific than what we know of Agent Orange, but that's the inspiration though. And now these guys are having all these symptoms and all these nightmares and medical issues, and some of them are being killed to cover up the secret. And Jacob's kind of caught caught up in that whole situation. He's seeing demons, and the imagery in this movie is really strong. Like, there's Adrian Lyne is the director here, and he does a pretty great job with creating some really terrific horror imagery. But then you have these preachy moments where we're talking about government corruption and the horrible things. Like, the movie ends on a title card that feels out of place where we've just been, because we've just been revealed this kind of cool twist, and then he's making this very serious real point about things that actually happened in history. And it's like these two things just don't fit together properly. And in the end, I'm left a little cold about this movie, just because they're trying to thread a needle here that they just don't quite thread.
Yeah, I mean, it would be like if you're watching like Night of the Living Dead or Dawn of the Dead, and they put like title cards in there to explain what they're trying to show you with the zombie symbolism. They should have just left it to symbolism alone and then made their movie.
You see this black man gets shot at the end by these white people, which is always what happens.
Right, that's how it ends, with the title card explaining it. And that's kind of what this is, though, in a way. You know, if you just leave it to symbolism alone, I think it's way stronger. It could have been a little – it would probably been on a little thicker than those movies are, but it still would have worked. I mean, the twist alone is pretty impressive in that it kind of makes up for a lot of that, the clunkiness, it was a little confusing at times, but it's still cool, like you said, the horror imagery.
You call it confusing. I think disorienting is a better
word.
I think intentionally they're trying to throw you into his mindset of being terribly lost within all of what's happening to him.
Absolutely. And then the twist helps you, not go home pissed off at that. But right. you about being confused, I'm just disoriented. The new one did not. It was just kind of like, okay, that was dumb. It's fine, this movie. I like it, but I don't love it. It's not one I talk about a lot. It's just kind of I've seen it before. I watched it again this weekend. It is what it is. There's things I like about it. There's things I don't. And I just kind of move on, I guess. That's kind of all I have to say about it.
Yeah, I think the twist is more memorable than the movie itself. And, the shorthand that Jacob's Ladder scenario provides is a nice one. Jason Mantzoukas uses it a lot on How Did This Get Made? It's a running gag that they have talking about whether or not a movie is a Jacob's Ladder scenario, which, spoiler alert, I'm just going to tell you what it is that a Jacob's Ladder scenario is where the character's been dead the entire time.
Don't ruin it.
You can cut that out if you want to.
No, I'm kidding. What are they going to call it? The Sixth Sense scenario?
I don't think people are ready to ruin that movie yet.
We watched that with our kids. There was the last week. My wife made them watch at least, and they were bored to tears. But my daughter was more into it than my son, but...
Not enough blood and guts for him?
No. Well, I mean, it's a slow burn, and slow burns don't work on kids as well.
Yeah.
I mean, there was moments that terrified him, but... Jacob's Ladder, every now and then you'll see it pop up on a list of, like, surprisingly good horror movies or whatever, and I don't know.
It's good. It's a good movie. In some ways, it's not great movie in other ways. And I think if Adrian Lyne had just leaned more into if this were like a Dario Argento movie, that might be where this needed to go to meet its potential.
Yeah. I mean, that's what's frustrating about this movie, because the potential is one of the best of the year. And when you just kind of fall in the middle, that almost makes me hate you. You know what I'm saying? Man on Fire is a movie that kind of one that I can't stand because of that. And this is, I don't know why I still like it enough, because at least I think it's because the twist made me feel good about not getting what was going on until then it all just kind of made sense.
That hospital scene is really great, with him being wheeled through the hospital and the gurney, the imagery that he puts into that. That is some really terrific horror movie imagery. And that scene alone sells me enough on this movie to like it, if not think it's one of the great movies of all time.
Yeah, I'd almost
want great horror movies or whatever.
Yeah, I'd almost want to see David Lynch make it, but make him have the twist where it's explained. You don't have to put the title cards, but make the twist exist, because David Lynch wouldn't put the twist in. He'd just make you go, what the fuck did I just watch? But if you had that at the end of like Mulholland Drive, you're like, oh my God, this is amazing. Okay. Let's just run to our classic, and then we'll get to the 1990 movies or the other 1990 movies. Oh, great. Now I got to put my password in and hit the button.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the main event for the linear, legitimate, and universally recognized, undisputed classic,
Young Frankenstein.
Young Frankenstein, 1974, I think it was,
yes.
With Mel Brooks directing and Gene Wilder as the star. Here is Dr. Josef von Frankenstein. The story goes that he's inherited his family's Transylvanian castle, and he's going to Transylvania for the first time to take on his family legacy. Of course, his family is well known for having maybe created a monster, or at least tried to create a monster. We're not quite sure where this falls in that category. But he's going to end up obviously creating his own Frankenstein, played by Peter Boyle. And we're going to get a lot of the homage to the original Frankenstein, from the scene with the little girl with the daisy to the scene with the blind man. We get a lot of classic riffs on those scenes. And man, I find this very hard to say. This movie doesn't hold up for me. I was kind of bored watching it this time. I don't know what it is about this. Maybe I've fallen so deeply in love with the original Frankenstein that I'm just kind of watching this going, okay, but why is that funny? Because so much of this feels like the original Frankenstein with like gentle twists. Like there's the scene with the girl with the daisy. Obviously, it's an iconic thing from Frankenstein where, you know, he's the monster misunderstands the situation and ends up killing this little girl. Here you have him toss her into her bed, gently putting her to bed. That's the joke. And all of it just comes off as sort of mildly amusing. And I go into a Mel Brooks movie like thinking of, Blazing Saddles or something like that, where it's just laughs us every second, just every minute. There's a new big joke. And this movie has a lot of dead space where it's just kind of paying homage to the original Frankenstein. a lot of it comes down to like if you buy into Gene Wilder's just kind of manic energy, and I didn't this time. I didn't buy into his manic energy. I wasn't buying what he was selling in terms of just him trying to force this movie into being energetic through his manic energy, and it just wasn't working. And I don't hate Young Frankenstein. It's too good to be bad, but I didn't love it the way I thought I had in the past, because I know I've seen this movie before and enjoyed it. At least I think I did. But did I force myself to like it based off of history and nostalgia? I'm not quite sure now.
When's the last time you saw Blazing Saddles?
Oh, gosh, like a week and a half ago. Oh. I love Blazing Saddles.
I was wondering, I don't know if I've ever seen it, period. But I was wondering if that actually held up or not. So I'm glad to hear it does.
This if you've not seen Blazing Saddles, it's so funny.
This one, it's one of those where, like, I know that's funny, but I'm not, like, the whole bookcase scene, it's not funny today. It was probably funny then. The part where they dance, it's kind of funny, but it's not as funny today as it probably was when it first came out.
Well, and especially since you've probably seen that in every, AFI clip show or, repeated numerous times in Oscar montages. Like, you've seen that scene so many times, there's no possible way that has any impact anymore.
Right, and throw on top of that how many times I've seen Airplane and Naked Gun and Hot Shots, which, that's more my generation of comedy, at least that type of parody comedy. I had never seen this going in. I knew about it. I knew certain things in it. And it was one of those where I get it, but it's not as fun as it should be. And I feel bad. I feel like I'm, I don't think it's fair to the movie. I think it's fair to say it doesn't hold up, but I understand why it was so good in 1974, if that makes any sense. But it doesn't. I don't know. It didn't really do it for me. I knew that one thing I liked about it, or I knew going in, the song Walk This Way from Aerosmith came from this movie, which I thought was cool. But then I'm like, that's really, that made you do that song. That's like the first line of the movie, and it's almost, it's not funny. So I don't even know why that line stuck with you to make a song. But I don't know.
That is a weird one. And then we just watched the Last Picture Show recently and saw how wonderful Cloris Leachman was. And I watched this movie, and I know that what she's doing is supposed to be funny, but then she just disappears. Like, they do this bit repeatedly where every time they say her name, the horses get spooked. And that's the only joke. That's it. You say Frau Blücher and the horses get spooked. And that's the only thing they do with her. And then she's gone. Like, she disappears from the movie for the third act. She's just not around. And I kept thinking, like, why did you hire Cloris Leachman for this?
Yeah, but I mean, I wonder if it's like the kids younger than us that are really, I know you liked Scary Movie, but the ones that jumped onto that era of parody, if they don't think Hot Shots and Airplane are as good as, or even the, like, I like Hot Shots better than Airplane. So even the people a little bit older than me who would say Airplane's, you know, the peak, the pinnacle, maybe, you know, I'm just wondering if it's just because you've seen that type of humor too many times and you like the one that came out when you were at the right age, that it kind of, it's the same humor. It just, it's applied to an older generation. So I don't know. I just feel like it's more redundant and repetitive, and I've seen it enough, and I think my generation's the best. So, I don't know.
I don't have the same nostalgia necessarily for Hot Shots that you do. I appreciate Hot Shots. I think it's funny, but I don't really have that kind of nostalgia for it. I do have that for Airplane and Airplane 2, which I did grow up on and
right.
and did love so very much. But Blazing Saddles is the peak of the genre. That is the height of this genre. It is just so funny, that one, and Spaceballs too. I think is better than people give it credit for.
Spaceballs sucks.
I love Spaceballs.
I mean, granted, I'm bringing some baggage to it, so don't get me wrong.
And I love Robin Hood Men in Tights as well. I think people are way too hard on Robin Hood Men in Tights.
Never seen it. See, that's the other thing, is I haven't seen enough Mel Brooks, and I Star Wars annoys me to the point where I can't appreciate Spaceballs. So far, like Young Frankenstein, the best of the two. But
I would have thought you would love Spaceballs just for that joke about Spaceballs 2, The Search for More Money. I mean, it's not gentle on Star Wars.
I know.
He throws some punches.
But the Star Wars fans love it, so it's... I don't know. There's no real reason. I shouldn't say I hate it. I just don't care. It's like Weird Al. I appreciate Weird Al, but I'm still going to take the original songs. And I'm sick of people saying his songs are better than like Nirvana or whatever. But I don't know. Maybe I need to just rewatch them all with a fresh look, especially see Blazing Saddles for the first time, and maybe Robin Hood Men in Tights. We'll have to find reasons to watch those. I mean, Blazing Saddles deserves to be a classic at some point. Maybe the week of Dances with Wolves.
Yeah, I absolutely. Let's do that for my own sanity, so I can watch Blazing Saddles again before I have to suffer through Dances with Wolves.
Josh is going to be so happy. Why isn't it some Clint Eastwood movie? Nope, it's going to be Blazing Saddles. But yeah, Young Frankenstein is what it is. I appreciate for what it was, and at the time, I'm sure it was groundbreaking, and but not as groundbreaking as Roger Corman's Frankenstein Unbound. So much funnier.
I did not expect this to be the funniest Frankenstein movie this week. I really didn't, but it's the funniest Frankenstein movie.
And it's not, it is and it isn't funny on accident. You know, Roger Corman has such a weird way of, it's not Tommy Wiseau, it's something else. But it's, I don't know, it's fun bad, but in a better way than some of the bad movies. I don't know.
It's kind of Ed Wood. I really think there's an element of Ed Wood to this version of Corman anyway, because I do see in hiring John Hurt, Raul Julia, I think he's and you know, Jason Patrick, Bridget Fonda, I think he actually is aiming for respectability here. I think Roger Corman thought he was making a real movie this time, and that makes this so poignant and so sad at the same time. Like, just aw. Like, I just want to pat him on the back. Aw, Roger, no. You're not making a real movie. Look what you did. Look what you made these poor dignified human beings do. And that just makes it so much funnier for me. So Frankenstein Unbound stars John Hurt as a scientist in the modern age who has defied God and destroyed the planet, destroyed time. And he ends up being sent back in time along with his Batman Camaro car with as a printer in it. It goes back in time with that to the early 1800s, to the time where both Mary Shelley and Victor Frankenstein exist, which is funny in its own way because she created Victor Frankenstein. But in this scenario, Victor Frankenstein has already created his monster, and his monster is wreaking havoc, destroying things. And the villagers are so stupid that they think a tiny girl, a tiny teenage girl, has murdered a child by tearing it in half in a way that no human being could possibly do. But they're just dumb villagers. What are you going to do? So the middle portion of this movie is spent with John Hurt barely even taking notice of the fact that he's time traveled. Like, he doesn't even seem remotely like, oh, I've time traveled. Okay. Now I'm going to try and spend my time trying to rescue this girl who we never meet. Does she even have a name? I don't even know. But the entire middle section of the movie is him about him trying to save her life before he starts banging Mary Shelley. Mary Shelley, played by Bridget Fonda, who I love. I love Bridget Fonda, but that wonderfully slippery English accent he's got her working is just hilarious. And then, you know, she has this line where she says, where she justifies boning John Hurt's character by saying that, you know, Percy and Shelley, they talk about free love, but I practice it. Just, I could not stop laughing at her delivery of that line and the way her accent slips throughout. And then just the god awful sex scene between her and John Hurt, as if John Hurt has ever been a sex symbol ever. Really? No, he's been 60 years old his entire life. He's never been a sex symbol.
Have you seen The Elephant Man? It's not funny. I apologize.
Then she's choosing to sleep with him over Jason Patrick and Michael Hutchence of NXS. Come on, really? I guess, is that the joke? Is that the joke? Is that she's choosing John Hurt? Oh, man. I tell you, I might have a hard time choosing between Bridget Fonda and Michael Hutchence. Honestly, that's how beautiful he is in this movie.
I'll agree with that. I love Michael Hutchence. He's one of those guys who are like, I want to be that when I get older. Until I found out what it ended up being, but at the time.
Oh, yeah. My favorite part, I'm not going to hold back on spoilers on this, because what's the point? Frankenstein's monster looks like a fucking joke. Just an absolute fucking joke. The deaths in this movie that he's responsible for, they look like Tom Savini rejects. Like, somebody wanted to parody Tom Savini, like take his work and do it just as bad as humanly possible, like with these rubber heads and rubber bodies, and make sure you get that rubber nipple on there. Get that out there.
Throw it across the camera real quick. Just throw it.
So bad. But my favorite part of the movie is the end, because it's so great, because John Hurt uses the clapper to kill Frankenstein. The clapper.
I don't get how you... Go ahead.
He uses a clapper to turn on lasers to kill Frankenstein.
I mean, how do you think he was being serious? Listen to everything you've said. It's a time-traveling Frankenstein movie that ends with the clapper. I feel like he knew what he was doing. Raul Julia is so serious that it's so funny as Victor Frankenstein. I don't know. I think Corman does such a great job of what Sharknado wants to do. You know, he does it better than anybody else.
I think you're giving him credit. I do.
I mean, anytime
I've seen a documentary about Roger Corman, I don't think he's fully aware of just how bad his movies are. I think he's in it for a buck. He's a huckster.
Oh, he's definitely in it for a buck. And
occasionally I think, like in this case, I think he strives for a little bit of respectability and, I'm going to hire real actors this time, and this is what we get.
I agree completely that he's in it for a buck. I absolutely, but he's also Like, everybody that's ever come through Hollywood, especially throughout the 70s, went through Corman at one point.
And, right. Because but they went with him because he was he was willing to let people who'd never directed anything direct things.
No, I understand. I agree completely. He's like the king of the low-budget movie and turning a profit on it. But I don't know. I have a hard time. One, none of these, like, Jason Patrick wasn't Jason Patrick yet. Bridget Fonda wasn't Bridget Fonda yet. Raul Julia, maybe John Hurt and Raul Julia were like the biggest stars at the time. I know Lost Boys had come out, but still, that was more of Corey Feldman than anything. I don't know. I think it's funny whether he was trying to be serious or not. Personally,
I think you'd have to buy into the same theory that Tommy Wiseau made a comedy out of The Room. If you want to buy into that he was trying to make this intentionally funny, you'd have to buy also that Tommy Wiseau was making a comedy in The Room.
I disagree, only because he ends the movie with the clapper. I think you can make a better argument that this was being made as a comedy, or at least a partial comedy.
I think a guy his age thought that this right here, that's the future.
I think
that's his sad vision of the future. Like, everything will be controlled just by clapping.
I don't know. Just making a time traveling Frankenstein movie alone seems to be like, this guy's not taking himself seriously. I know the casting. I don't know. I think it's good either way, in the right way. It's not, obviously, it's a terrible movie, but it's insanely fun.
Wonderful.
Right, it's insanely fun, no matter how you look at it. In my opinion, I have a hard time believing that a guy with that much experience would make a time traveling Frankenstein movie and think he's doing it for real. But it does add a little bit of fun.
He's looking at this, going, "This is a modern take. I'm being modern and I'm being new, and this is my '90s take on Frankenstein." And I really do think there's a self seriousness to this and a complete lack of winking on his part that is I think quite evident.
I think if there was a real budget behind it, maybe.
Well, this is the biggest budget that he's ever had. I mean, he put more money into this than he's put into anything ever, which again leads to me to my theory that here he is spending money and hiring real actors for the first time. I do think that this was intentional. I mean, whether or not Bridget Fonda had been in much of anything at that time, she's still a Fonda, you know. And Michael Hutchins is the lead singer of NXS. He was a superstar. He was definitely going out of his way to make something that he thought would be like his banner blockbuster. This is going to be my breakthrough.
All I'm going to say is I disagree. It doesn't matter. either way, I still enjoyed it similar to the way you did. Obviously, maybe you found certain things funnier because of your opinion of it versus mine, but it still is insanely fun to watch because it's such a dumb idea.
It's free on YouTube. If you want to watch it, folks, it's free on YouTube.
Frankenstein Unbound. And watch it and let me know who you agree with, me or Sean. I'm just curious. It's an argument that doesn't really matter, but I'm curious.
Completely meaningless.
Yeah. Right. I'm curious what everybody thinks. But in a lot of ways, the most memorable movie of the week.
Oh, absolutely. It's the takeaway of the week for sure.
Did you watch China Cry or Graffiti Bridge?
I've seen Graffiti Bridge in the past. It's a bad movie. It's Prince, so it's right. Bad in a very interesting way at the very least. He plays this foppish modern, but also in the past. It's weird trying to figure out the time frame of this film. He's a man whore. He's a, you know, gigolo, gets hired to have sex with women, but he also is falling in love with this woman played by Kristen Scott Thomas. And he's just Prince, and there's an element of charm to it. At the same time, he doesn't know how to make a movie. And so you're watching a guy who is, you know, resting this entirely on his charm, and he's charming to the point where it's almost, you know, passable, but it's such a bad movie and such poor direction, just so pointless in many ways that you can't get behind it.
Yeah, I mean, he definitely seems like a guy capable of making the room.
Yeah.
He's a genius in some way, you know, musically, don't get me wrong. But I can see him taking himself serious enough to make a really bad movie that's so bad it's good for the wrong reasons. I don't think he would ever do what Tommy Wiseau does and pretend it was a comedy.
I think Prince at a certain point, like at this point in 1990, they just back up this truck full of money. And he's like, let me see how far I can go. All right, I'll star in the movie, but I also want to direct it. And they're like, well, you're Prince. We want to be in business. Let's do this. What's that? You want Final Cut? All right.
See, I feel like it's all Prince initiating it. And then the truck full of money. Oh, everybody's bidding for it and letting him do what he wants because they're going to get Purple Rain 2, and which is what this is supposed to be. But I don't know. Just based on the stories I've heard about Prince, or at least I should say, based on the Kevin Smith stories I've heard about Prince, this seems very possible. I guess that's all the movies we have this week. Next week, we got Emperor. It's on Hulu. Fishbowl, I believe you can rent on at least YouTube. La Llorona and Host are both on Shudder, I believe. And then our classic is Marmee, and if we're really feeling froggy, we could do Zardoz. I might give it a shot. Child's Play 2 and The Craze came out in 1990.
K-R-A-Y-S, Craze,
yes, K-R-A-Y-S,
just so you know.
K-R-A-Y-S, yes, that is true. But yeah, so next week we'll pay somewhat tribute to Sean Connery via red diapers and Alfred Hitchcock. Hopefully both. But that is a show. Go to patreon.com/criticspod. You can go to flickchart.com too, and it's a fun game to play there. But patreon.com/criticspod to help support the podcast, and our T Public page at ihatecritics.net/. I don't know what the slash is, but just click on the T Public link, or go to T Public and search Critics Pod if you want some merch. Now to flickchart.com. Hot Shots Part Duh, 16 Candles.
16 Candles.
I won't even make you flip. I do like Hot Shots better, but it's not a fair comparison. So I will concede. I will do what Trump won't do tomorrow. The Kingsmen, Secret Service, Notting Hill.
Secret what?
Kingsmen, the Secret Service.
Oh, okay.
Notting Hill.
Notting Hill.
The Frighteners, 1996. Three Men and a Baby.
Hey. Three Men and a Baby.
I agree. Unforgiven, The Village.
Unforgiven.
can't wait till that turns 30. Wish that turned 30 this year. Gandhi, The Recruit.
The Recruit is another. I hate The Recruit too. I think, but Gandhi is just so fucking long. Good God.
Yeah, I'll never know if it's a good movie or not because I'm not going to watch it. Child's Play, Men in Black 2.
Men in Black 2.
I don't really care. I'm just going to make you flip for fun. Child's Play, yay.
Boo.
The Hurt Locker, Iron Man 2.
Hurt Locker.
Agree. Nacho Libre, It's a Wonderful Life.
Oh.
You're going to take Nacho Libre, aren't you?
I am, because I can't get into It's a Wonderful Life. As much as I love and respect Jimmy Stewart, it's just, I'm so tired of it.
I am too. I'm going to flip it out of principle. I mean, I feel like at least deserves that. Nacho Libre does win the coin flip, though. So. I mean, I'll never. It's weird because all my life, that's all I knew Jimmy Stewart from until this podcast. I mean, I guess as I became more of a movie fan, I was aware of the movies he made, but I didn't start watching them until this podcast. And it was just like, he makes some of the best movies of that era, and this is the one he's remembered for. That's kind of frustrating.
Yeah.
Clerks 2, Prisoners.
Clerks 2.
Even over, what's his name?
I love that movie. I love that movie, but yeah, Clerks 2 is awesome. I think people really underestimate it.
I agree, and I actually don't like Prisoners. I feel like I need to go back and watch it now that I like Denis even Villeneuve. But at the time, I was kind of annoyed by that movie. Arachnophobia, North by Northwest.
North by Northwest.
Agreed. There's Something About Mary, Pulp Fiction.
Pulp Fiction.
Heathers, Role Models.
That's tough. I like both those movies. Heathers.
Yeah, I feel like it's hard to pick Role Models. I'd probably watch that first, but Heathers is more... I feel like I'm more obligated to pick that one, if that makes sense. Spider-Man Homecoming, Liar Liar.
Spider-Man Homecoming.
That's fine. The Net, AI.
AI.
I won't argue. Downfall, 2004, Liar Liar.
Hitler or Jim Carrey?
Is that like a pro-Hitler movie or something?
Oh, no. Isn't that the one? I think
I haven't seen it, so I don't know. It is Hitler, yes. Yeah. Or it's either Hitler or Stalin. I can't tell based on the poster.
I mean, I actually really do like Liar Liar a lot. I probably never want to see Downfall again. It's an iconic Hitler performance. Like, it's the greatest Hitler on screen you've ever seen. If that's a good thing, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It'd be like watching a Charles Manson movie for real and not the Tarantino version. I don't want to see. You know, had that ended with the Charles Manson's killer murders, I would have been very... It would have kind of ruined the movie for me. So I could see your point. I've never seen Downfall, so I
don't know what
I'm talking about. Let's go Liar Liar. Good job. Heathers, While You Were Sleeping.
What is going on? Heathers.
Yeah. I'm reading Matthew McConaughey's book right now. And
yeah.
While You Were Sleeping was brought up in it, because that's how he became a star in a way, even though he's not in it. It is the most readable, unreadable book ever written. Because it's written like Matthew McConaughey talks. But
wow.
If you don't know, if you can't put his cadence and his tone into it,
yeah.
By doing that, it makes it insanely readable. But if you didn't do that, oh my God, it would just be words.
What does he have to do with?
Here's what has to do with While You Were Sleeping. Time to Kill, he auditioned to be, I think, Kiefer Sutherland's character.
Okay.
And he goes, I want to be Jake Brigance, you know, the main lawyer. And he goes, and the director, the one who just died, Schumacher. He goes, I want you to be the lead actor too, but they'll never let you be the lead actor because you're not a star yet. You're just a small name in Hollywood. And in the process, Sandra Bullock became a star. She was already attached to the movie, but because of While You Were Sleeping being such a big hit, she became a star. So she was a star they could put on the poster and allowed him to sneak in and become the lead.
Ah, that's clever.
Yeah. Little Nicky, Star Trek Into the Darkness.
Star Trek Into Darkness, by a lot.
By a lot. Avengers Infinity War, American Werewolf in London.
Avengers.
Yeah. I want to pick American Werewolf in London because it's considered a classic, but I don't know how attached I really am to it. Shrek Forever After, Tron Legacy.
Shrek.
Yeah.
Tron's just so boring.
Saturday Night Fever, Mean Girls.
Ooh, good one. Real good one. Mean Girls.
I've never actually seen Saturday Night Fever.
Yeah, you got a couple movies to catch up on with Blazing Saddles and Saturday Night Fever.
You got to make my classic. That's the only way I'll see him at this point in my life. It's hard to go back, especially when your wife doesn't like to watch old movies unless it's Sixth Sense or The Craft. Ghost World, Eagle Eye.
Ghost World.
Yeah. Star Wars, Run Lola Run.
Ooh. Ooh. I mean, Star Wars is much more watchable, so. Run Lola Run, though.
I'm not going to fight you on it. I don't know enough. I don't know if I've seen. I think I've seen it, but I don't remember it. So I would just be being a dick for the sake of being a dick. So I'm going to just go Star Wars. A Night at the Roxbury, Jurassic Park.
Jurassic Park. Yeah. I didn't need to think about that.
You're waiting for me to say part two. Dune, 1984. Blade, 1998.
Blade.
Yeah. Friday the 13th.
I just bought Blade on DVD. It was just there. It's like, I don't know. I bought it from Jeff. And yeah, I was like, yeah, Blade. I love Blade.
Yeah. Friday the 13th, Being Human.
Being Human.
I don't know what that is. Robin Williams. I've never seen it. So I'll just let you have
Wait,
it.
Wait, I thought that. I think that was a different movie. Never mind. Friday the 13th. Being Human's awful. That's a terrible film.
Oh, well, we picked Being Human because you were too quick. This is weird. I think we're going to have to flip for it, most likely. Irreversible, Ocean's 13.
Yeah, fuck Irreversible. Ocean's 13.
Why fuck Irreversible?
I hate that movie. That movie's disgusting.
I know, but I like disgusting. God damn it, you won the coin flip anyway.
Yes.
Sideways, Team America, World Police.
Sideways.
Yeah, as much as I like Team America, Sideways is pretty amazing. Saw 3, the Machinist.
Saw 3.
I agree. Colonia, 2015. Star Trek 6, The Undiscovered Country.
I don't know what Colonia is.
Looks like Emma Watson. Ghost, Star Trek 6, The Undiscovered Country.
Ghost.
Agreed. I think Michael, who joins our podcast on occasion, who does the Two Mics podcast, he posted a picture of, you know, the scene in Ghost where they're doing the pottery with Dan Aykroyd dressed as a Ghostbuster behind him. I had never seen that. I thought it was funny. Crash, 2004, Battle Royale.
Battle Royale.
Agreed. Doctor Strange, Blade Trinity.
Doctor Strange, yeah. Now, if it were Blade 2, I would have much more of a conflict.
Yeah. 127 Hours in Bruges.
Ooh, two awesome movies. It's 127 Hours, but In Bruges is so good.
Yeah. Castaway, A River Runs Through It.
Castaway.
Yep. The Stepford Wives, 2004, Zodiac.
Zodiac. If it had been 1967, I would have said the same thing.
That's true. Dr. Doolittle, 1998. The Tall Guy, 1989.
The Tall Guy. Just because I just like the poster. I've never seen the movie, but it's got to be better than Doolittle.
All right. Les Miserables, 2012. Rush Hour 3.
I mean, Les Miserables, obviously.
The Maltese Falcon, Don't Mess With My Sister, 1985.
Never heard of it.
Doesn't matter.
Yeah, it doesn't really.
Finding Dory, the Deer Hunter.